The Democracy Paradox podcast is sponsored by the Kellogg Institute for International Studies, part of the Keough School of Global Affairs at the University of Notre Dame. The Kellogg Institute has a 40-year history of excellence in advancing research and education on global democracy and human development. Learn more about the Kellogg Institute, including its world-renowned visiting fellowships for scholars at various stages of their careers at kellogg.nd.edu.
Welcome to the Democracy Paradox podcast. This is my daddy.
My name is Justin Kemp, and I am your host as we explore the Democracy Paradox. In 2015, the Law and Justice Party, or PiS, won the parliamentary elections in Poland. The name of the party is a little bit ironic, because observers argue they made every effort to weaken the rule of law in the country. So for 8 years, they subverted democratic norms and undermined democratic institutions. And they made a specific effort to capture the judiciary so they could largely ignore the Constitution because they lacked the votes to make a new one. However, this past year, a coalition government came to power in the Polish Sejm. It was the first step towards repairing the constitutional order and reversing democratic backsliding. But the process of democratic restoration is far more complicated than many of us assume. A lot is written on democratic backsliding, but very little is written about how to repair a damaged democracy. Tomasz Daly has thought a lot about constitutional repair and democratic renewal. He is a professor at Melbourne Law School and director of the Democratic Decay and Renewal DemDeck platform at www.democratic-decay.org. Recently, he wrote a working paper called Constitutional Repair, a Comparative Theory. I felt that his work on constitutional repair provided a good framework to discuss the issues facing Poland. We provide some background on Poland, but really try to focus on what the new governing coalition can do to revitalize its democracy. We also consider the dangers and pitfalls in repairing the constitutional order. It's an important topic because an increasing number of countries have found they face similar issues and dilemmas as they turn away from populist parties. Now, this is the second episode in a series of podcasts on issues relating to constitutional change, which is part of a partnership with the Constitution Building Program at International IDEA. IDEA is an intergovernmental organization that supports democracy worldwide, and the Constitutions Program conducts research and supports countries in strengthening democratic constitutions around the world. You can find more information at www.idea.int. The link is also in the show notes. The podcast is also sponsored by the Kellogg Institute for International Studies, part of the Keough School of Global Affairs at the University of Notre Dame. The Kellogg Institute was founded by Guillermo O'Donnell, one of the giants of democratic thought, more than 40 years ago. It continues to sponsor research on democracy and human development. Check them out at kellogg.nd.edu. You'll find a link in the show notes to their website. If you're interested in becoming a sponsor of the podcast, please send me an email to jkempf@democracyparadox.com. But for now, here is my conversation with Tomasz Daly. Tom Daly, welcome to the Democracy Paradox.
Thanks for having me.
So, Tom, I read your recent paper, working paper, Constitutional Repair, a Comparative Theory. I thought it was really insightful. It touched on a lot of the things that we talk about on this podcast, and I think it's going to help us to really think through one of the cases within this paper, which is Poland. I mean, it's a country that we've talked about for years now, and it's a country that's on many of our minds after the most recent elections, where we have a chance to be able to actually see constitutional repair in action.
But before we go too far down that road, can you talk just a little bit about why constitutional repair is really important? What sets that apart? Why is it that we should be thinking of constitutional repair rather than just democratic repair, repairing our democracy?
Yeah, that's a great question, because, you know, I've been working on this issue of democratic decay, backsliding for years. And, you know, with Poland as one of my focus countries alongside the likes of Hungary or Brazil or the USA, and increasingly India. But, you know, now we're faced with this question of all of these types of governments that are broadly anti-democratic, even though they're democratically elected, they cause a lot of damage to the constitutional system. So they're messing with courts, the legislature, independent institutions, rights, and so on. And I would see that as constitutional damage, whereas you might say broader democratic damage is all the things like the way they damage trust in institutions, the way they demonize their political opponents and poison the sort of political atmosphere, how they sort of leverage the changes to our information landscape in social media, disinformation, and so on. So the constitutional damage for me is the sort of core institutions that get affected by this type of government. And that's what I'm very focused on. But what we're stuck there with is, how do you approach repairing the institutions and the core damage that's been caused? Can extreme measures be justified? How do you conduct repair without it looking like simple revenge against the previous government? So I thought we needed a full framework to talk about these things, and that's where the paper came about. But the main thing that the paper actually tries to get across is we're in uncharted territory. You know, we're familiar with seeing transitions to democracy from full-on authoritarianism. So that might be communist rule or a military dictatorship. But the new paradigm is all shades of gray, right? So you're not talking about just a changeover of government in normal democratic times. You have extensive constitutional damage that's been caused by a previous government that was democratically elected, but you don't have a rupture with democratic rule. They've damaged the system, but not ended democracy. So you don't have a clear space and justification for a new constitution or new institutions, but you still need to fix the damage. And for me, there are just two possible extreme positions here. One is a new government can say, well, we're committed, let's say, small d Democrats, so we can't do anything that violates the law or democratic norms. And that puts them in a straitjacket and makes it very hard for them to actually achieve certain fixes that are needed. Or two, you could say the context really is more like a transition from authoritarianism to democracy. So anything goes in fixing the system. And I think generally, it's how do you tread a middle course between these two positions is where we're at, trying to stay within the law and democratic norms as much as humanly possible, but not closing the door on extreme measures if they really are necessary.
So Poland is a different case from many that we think of when we think of constitutional damage. For instance, Hungary is a country where they literally rewrote the entire constitution. Most Latin American countries, when they undergo democratic decay and constitutional damage, they rewrite their constitutions through methods that are a little bit dubious, questionable as to whether or not it's an entirely legitimate process. Poland, they didn't have the support to even amend the constitution. But at the same time, it feels like there were fundamental changes to the constitutional order. So what's your interpretation? Do you feel that in Poland that there has been constitutional damage, even though the constitution fundamentally has not been changed?
Absolutely. I think, you know, Poland is just this object lesson that you can fundamentally transform the constitutional order by leaving the constitutional text itself untouched. And what's really been the challenge here has been a whole load of scholars, Polish scholars like Wojciech Sadurski or Tomasz Konciewicz or Agnieszka Bienkasawa, and non-Polish scholars like Laurent Pesch or myself or Timi Adrianozzi, trying to really get into the detail of what's been done and seeing how it has changed the way that power operates in the country. So in Hungary, for example, of course, they got the 2/3 parliamentary majority to change the constitution, and they did change the constitution very early on. They also were able to pass constitutional amendments to the new constitution so that the constitutional court couldn't refer to its previous judgments before the new constitution. But the Law and Justice Party couldn't do that in Poland. You know, what they did instead was a number of different measures. So they sort of had this systematic, disciplined, relentless campaign that involved a whole load of measures. And I mean, Sadurski's called it legislative bombardment. You know, while they were trying to subordinate the Constitutional Tribunal, they just kept on passing this flurry of legislation, often through fast-track procedures, so up to 40% during 2016. And you had, you know, laws affecting the leadership, the operation, oversight of the Supreme Court and lower courts. You've laws changing vast swathes of the leadership of the civil service, how civil servants are appointed. You've laws establishing mirror bodies to supplant bodies established under the Constitution, like the media regulators. But it's not just law. You have this very broad-based strategy where law won't achieve it, they'll achieve it by other means. So they did things like appointing Constitutional Tribunal judges in contravention of the Constitution. They installed a new tribunal president very early on who did things like forcing existing judges to take their holiday leave so that they'd just be removed from the equation. You have the abuse of disciplinary proceedings against judges later on. But you also have measures taken to curb the opposition in Parliament. So things like expanded use of fast-tracking legislation, reducing opposition speeches to almost meaningless limits, and cutting off opposition politicians' mics when necessary. So what you end up with is this kind of schizophrenic constitutional order where the Constitution of 1997 still remains untouched and still proclaims the same, you know, nice separation of powers and individual liberties and judicial independence and so on, but it's mocked at every turn by actually how power has truly operated in the 8 years that peace were in power. And in many ways, the way it operates is reminiscent of communist governance, but is of course not a replication of it because they wanted to keep as much of a democratic facade as possible.
Now, the Constitutional Tribunal is fundamentally going to change now that there's a new governing coalition in power. Because when peace was in power, the role of the Constitutional Tribunal was effectively to rubber stamp legislation that peace passed. I mean, their role in terms of constitutional interpretation was to say it passed constitutional muster, even though most other constitutional scholars would have said that it would not have passed constitutional muster. So in many ways, I mean, that role no longer exists because they're either not going to get into the fray with the new governing coalition, because if they were willing to say that just about anything passed constitutional muster, they should allow the new governing coalition's legislation to pass, or they could go a different route, which is to become much more activist and to start using judicial review much more aggressively to say that legislation that the new coalition passes is not constitutional, to say that it's unconstitutional and it cannot be put into place. What direction do you think that this new constitutional tribunal is going to take? Do you think that it's going to become more activist, or do you think that the fact that they were much more passive in the past might signal that they might just remain passive in the future in terms of allowing a broad range of legislation to pass?
Yeah, I mean, this is sort of a central question, really, for constitutional repair in Poland, because, you know, Sadurski has described the journey of the tribunal under PiS is originally it was an activist court, or I would call it just a robust court that was carrying out its constitutional role before they came into power. Then it was paralyzed for a short period while they were trying to sort of subordinate it, and then it became a government enabler. And so you have sort of this very compromised top court. It has very little or no legitimacy, in fact, across society. What's interesting is we're starting to see some assessments of its judgments over the peace period entirely come out in recent times, especially in the English language. So in a recent book chapter, you have the former judge of the tribunal, Lech Garliski, writing with Marta Derlatka. They say that the court sort of coincides to a very considerable degree with the needs of the political majority, by which they mean the government. They say since 2017, the legal position of the government hasn't been rejected in any serious case. So you do see this sort of court that doesn't really act like a court anymore. You know, it's simply an enabler. And what's interesting as well is looking into detail, you know, Wojciech Brazowski in a recent book chapter as well, looks at their practices of interpretation. And he says they didn't really come up with any new model of how they were going to sort of act or interpret the Constitution. They just combine existing methods of interpretation in any way that will produce the desired result. So he says it's purely instrumental and result oriented. It's all about winning. That's the way he puts it. And his chapter is called Whatever Works. So you basically have this court that is just doing whatever works to enable the government that put them into power. Because you have to keep in mind here that this is a moving target. You know, they installed three unconstitutional appointed judges early on, and then you have a new president installed. And then by sort of 2018, you have a peace appointee majority. It's only in 2021 that the final non-peace appointee leaves the court. So what you have now is just an entirely peace appointed court. And what we don't know is how they'll act actually fully under the new government. Because if you look at places like Argentina, there's a whole sort of scholarship on how the courts can sometimes switch, not switch allegiance, but they will sort of try to maintain themselves somehow in the new dispensation. I think it's just too early to tell, but I also think they're too compromised to be able to manage a switch. And certainly it's not going to be a switch like the US Supreme Court did in the 1930s to prevent itself being attacked. I think there is just a broad consensus across the new government side of politics that this institution simply cannot continue to exist in its present form.
Do you get the sense that their interpretations are consistent? Like, do they have a consistent interpretation of the Constitution, or is it just an instrumental interpretation, kind of like you described before? I mean, because if it is instrumental, it gives me the sense that this judiciary, and not just the Constitutional Tribunal, but up and down the courts, is going to be a persistent threat to democracy until their terms expire.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think this is the working assumption of everyone who's sort of invested in constitutional repair in Poland, that this is an irretrievable court. This is not going to be an institution that can sort of make a switch and start sort of interpreting the Constitution in a more defensible way, and certainly not in any way sort of reminiscent of the pre-peace era. I think also, you know, there are just question marks over the people who were appointed. But I think a big issue here on top of everything else, which is coming up again and again, is there has been a change of government, but Poland has a semi-presidential system. So you have President Duda still in power until summer 2025. And he not only has a veto over a range of matters, which, you know, the current government doesn't have the 60% majority in parliament to override that, but also he can transfer issues over to the Constitutional Tribunal. So you could see this kind of remnants of the peace era working in sort of concert to effectively just bar as much of the measures that the new government wants to enact as possible. We don't know whether that's actually going to happen. President Duda has said that he's going to be collaborative, but all of his actions have spoken very much the opposite so far. So you're really stuck. You're stuck with, what do you do to change this court?
Yeah, President Duda is an interesting figure because if I remember right, he actually vetoed some of the legislation that was passed to kind of undermine the judiciary in Poland early on in the process. So sometimes he's taken a stand for the rule of law within Poland and been a more moderate voice of peace. But in many other ways, he's been just another politician that's kind of a mouthpiece for Jarosław Kaczynski. So it's hard to say what he's going to do because, again, he has taken stands against his party on occasion. So, I mean, it's possible that he could be what we would expect from a peace politician, but maybe less damaging than we assume.
I think the period since the new government came into office in November has, I think, mostly pointed to a very conflictual sort of stance by President Duda. Although you can never be fully sure because none of us are psychic, I think some of the past sort of actions taken by the president could be as much seen as part of the, what I think it's Kim Szepla calls the peacock dance that some of these governments partake in, to look like they're taking things seriously while other things are being prepared in parallel. So some of the stances that might seem sort of pro-democratic in the past could be viewed through that lens, but we just don't know. All we can look at is the evidence before us since the new government took power, and we're gearing up for just continual conflict. That's what it looks like. Until something gives. So, I mean, it could be all the way up till summer 2025, you have a sort of, you know, rolling constitutional crisis, essentially, because there's no way the government can get rid of this president. And all they can hope for is a more amenable president or a president that shares their values after the elections in 2025. So once again, looking at it as an outsider, of course, I'm looking at this as an outsider, but certainly all of the signs point to conflict in my view.
So looking at the judiciary, what options does Poland have to kind of repair their constitutional order? An obvious one that comes to mind would be to add more justices to the court to try to balance things out. But are there other solutions that exist as well that they can take? Are there more aggressive stances that they could take that could fix this problem or improve the situation within Poland?
Yeah. So when you listen to various Polish commentators and observers talking about this, you know, there seems to be just a broad consensus that because the three unconstitutionally appointed judges were unconstitutionally appointed, then it's perfectly legal to simply remove and replace them. But what you're dealing with then is that it's still a very small minority on the court. And so you wouldn't be fixing really the peace dominance on the court in that sense.
Can I ask you more about that, actually? So the three judges that were appointed illegitimately, their terms are up like this next year, aren't they? I mean, they've got maybe 12 more months, and then you're only changing three judges out of 15. It seems like that would be not moving the needle that much and potentially damaging the Constitution further without really making much of a gain. Is that your read on this too?
This is a very difficult political and constitutional calculation that you're dealing with, because essentially, if the Constitutional Tribunal does decide to simply be a complete veto actor, and we still don't know precisely how it is going to act because it is early days yet. But if it does, what you're dealing with is just such a central obstacle that it might be worth it to actually do the removal and replacement. Now, for some people, they would say if it was worth doing it on principle basis anyway, because they were unconstitutionally appointed. But I think that might be trapping you in difficult circumstances where you might need to take extraordinary measures in other ways that would be, at the very least, not in line with democratic norms. So like expanding the court, if you are presenting yourself as completely lily white, but then you're taking other measures, I think you would have to be very careful about how you present it. But essentially, even if you're just dealing with natural turnover, I don't think it's really a solution as such. And I think more than anything, it's just about articulating why you're doing it very clearly, because in one way, you're never going to win over like the peace side of politics or their political base. Everything you do is going to be seen as illegitimate. So what you really need to do is be clear on why you're doing it for the society at large, voters in general, the public in general. You have external audiences like the EU, and you also need to sort of be mindful of posterity, I think, when you're engaging in some of these measures, because you want to have a clear articulation of why this is necessary and why other options are not on the table. In the Polish case, there aren't other options on the table. If it was a classic transition from authoritarianism to democracy, you could probably set up a new institution and just start with a fresh slate. But you're not in that situation. You know, you're not going to be getting a new constitution. You're not going to be able to sort of do a reset. So what you're trying to do is retrieve democratic functioning within a very sort of compromised democratic order and retrieve judicial functioning within a very compromised judicial order. And that is never going to look good. But, you know, you just have to see what options are on the table. So for me, what I've been thinking about is, you know, removal and replacement of the so-called illegal judges, possibly a Kenya-style review of individual justices to assess whether they are suited to sit on the Constitutional Tribunal. That assessment could include a lot of non-political figures so that it doesn't simply look like a political witch hunt. And you could also look at expansion. But, you know, once again, there's so many different strands to the debate in Poland right now that I haven't seen any detailed sort of proposal that sort of brings everything together yet. But I'm hoping to see, you know, more come out, and I expect more will come out in even the coming sort of weeks and months, because this is just such a priority issue.
What's the downside to just doing nothing? I mean, waiting for the terms to expire, because in Poland, justices do have term limits. They have a set term that eventually the justice leaves the court and the Sejm, the parliament, is able to nominate a new justice to put onto the court. Why not just wait this out rather than risking damage to the institution of the judiciary long term?
Well, I think the judiciary is so damaged already. This is an area that needs almost total reset. Now, that is not to tar every judge in Poland with the same brush. You know, you've had a lot of resistance by Polish judges. You've had a lot of resistance in the courtroom, but also outside the courtroom, the March of 1,000 Robes in January 2020. You know, you saw them out doing a silent vigil, making themselves seen, protesting what the government was doing. But the judiciary as a whole, its legitimacy is very compromised. So I think we need to be mindful about starting from any assumption that there is, you know, a high point of legitimacy that we need to be careful about. I think it is really more about what is to be lost and what is potentially to be gained. And that is a lot of what constitutional repair is about. It's making these difficult assessments about the trade-off. I was just chatting with, you know, Polish colleagues, and we were talking about how there are hawks and doves on the constitutional repair question. And some people are much more sort of open to extraordinary measures. And definitely I would see myself as a hawk if that is the sort of binary we're working with. But I would see the trade-off as being worth it to remove a major obstacle to repair and to sort of just start the process of rehabilitating the courts, both functionally, but also their reputation in the eyes of the public. You know, before the peace government came into power, one of the reasons they were able to attack the judiciary was they had a very bad reputation anyway in terms of their public perception of them as being a very isolated elite, very sort of self-regarding and so on. So it's just a question of, is it worth it? And for me, I would say it is.
So would you say that constitutional damage really began before peace took over? That there was damage to the institutions that was happening before the populists came to power, and the populists really accelerated and exacerbated those problems that existed?
I think that's absolutely true of virtually every country in which we're seeing this type of phenomenon unfold. Democratic decay or democratic backsliding doesn't just come out of nowhere. But what you see is, what are issues that the electorate faces, including things like economic disadvantage, for example, or the losers from liberal or neoliberal governance, there is always sort of a certain level of disaffection that can be mobilized. And what some people have called sort of the way that the likes of the Peace Party have gone about this is they're able to marshal a very clear political identity. So theirs is, you know, we will help you out. There are still lots of communists in government. You know, you are not being heard. We are going to hear you. We're going to sort you out. And you do see sort of that being expressed in terms of economic largesse, for example, with the economic assistance, social assistance given to families, for example, under the peace government. But more than anything, these are parties that are willing to go where your normal democratic party is not willing to go, because they construct a whole set of enemies, the political opposition being the main enemy, but you also see them then going after a whole load of, you know, minorities, women, LGBT communities, refugees, migrants, you know, you name it, because they want to create an us versus them. And you really supercharge your political base and construct a political base by doing that. But you're doing it in a way that is not open to an actual, genuinely democratic political party, because they won't go there.
So one of the conundrums that I face when I think about some of the reforms that were made in Poland and in terms of trying to undergo constitutional repair is that one of the reforms that was made was to lower the retirement age of the justices. And that allowed PiS to be able to eject a lot of justices wholesale and appoint a whole bunch of justices at once up and down the court system. Reversing that reform would seem counterproductive because it would allow those peace judges to be able to remain in office even longer, potentially. I mean, I would think that you'd want to keep that reform in place, not because it's the right law or because it's the wrong law, but just because going backwards would be working against the progress that you want to make to be able to remove some of those justices. It just seems like one of many examples where once these changes have been put into place, it's almost impossible to go backwards. You have to somehow not necessarily go forwards, but kind of go in almost a new direction. And I don't know exactly where that takes us, but just the idea that you can't just reverse those old reforms just kind of boggles my mind, to be honest.
Absolutely. I mean, this is why in the paper I published in December, this working paper, I sort of say we can't see constitutional repair as being like repairing a broken leg. You know, it's just not as straightforward as that. So I use the visual motif of kintsugi, which is the Japanese art of repairing ceramics. And so you're trying to take the pieces and take all the damage and repair it by sort of reconstituting it, pulling them together using, you know, in kintsugi, it's gold or different sort of precious metals. So you'll reconstruct the artifact, but that's an unusual thing to do. And you might have to do unusual things in constitutional repair as well. So what's interesting there is, you know, there has been an attempt to a certain extent by the new government, the new coalition government, to kind of do a simple, straightforward reversal on some issues and just reverse some of the measures taken by the peace government. So they tried to clean house, for example, by dismissing peace-appointed national prosecutor and a range of peace appointees at government-backed academic and social insurance bodies. But then when they got to things like trying to deal with media freedom, because, you know, this is a massive area that was affected by the peace government, they basically turned public media into a government propaganda machine. And the new government very recently forcibly replaced the boards of three state-funded media organizations established or stacked by peace. And they also moved to liquidate state broadcasters as well. And these measures didn't stick, right? So they were trying to just put the genie back in the bottle, but they were not only declared illegal by a Warsaw court, but they've also been this central rallying cry to peace in opposition and their supporters about maintaining a free media and democracy. So it's really been a big sort of optics win for peace in that sense. And I think it's fair to say that the new government handled that issue fairly clumsily, but they don't have the peace option of just ignoring or trying to circumvent the judgment that's been handed down. You're operating with less freedom to maneuver compared to the government that came before you. So even trying to just do a straightforward reversal is extremely difficult. And I think that the new government has also been criticized in the way they took this action as basically just replicating the type of tactic that peace itself was strongly criticized for. And I think the big danger here is if you're not articulating why it's necessary very adeptly, if you're not thinking strategically, if you're not trying to think through how do we sequence this and how do we deal with the risk assessment, you're actually just handing a gift to the anti-democratic opposition if they get into government again. Because, I mean, here, coalition as a whole has 53 and something percent support in the recent elections. You know, peace is 35%. And so they're not decimated by any stretch of the imagination. They're still a viable political force. So I think you need to be really thinking about these issues. But I think we have to avoid trying to expect some sort of perfect constitutional repair process by a new government. You know, it's already so difficult to just win elections in a very sort of distorted electoral system. I mean, they won the elections through sheer force of organization and discipline with a ton of just wall-to-wall state government propaganda. So I think we have to avoid the idea that you can plan the constitutional repair part down to its detail. But I do think more thought needs to be put in if you're going to do it effectively. And for me, maybe this is somewhere where civil society and academia comes into the frame. Maybe they can help to chew through the very difficult questions arising. But of course, there again, you know, you look at the academic debate and you have the hawks and doves, and there's no consensus on what should be done. But at least by looking at the debate, you can come up with choices, you know, more choices rather than having to simply go for the easiest target available.
Yeah, I think you're almost underselling too how much support PiS still has. I mean, it is the largest single party within the Polish parliament. I mean, they had the option to try to form a government, and the reason why they couldn't was because nobody else wanted to work with them. The ones that are the governing coalition is a coalition of center-right parties, far-left parties. It's really everybody except for this far-right populist party. And so you've got people that are unified on the idea that they believe in democracy within Poland and that something needs to be done to preserve it and to fight for the constitutional order once again. But there isn't necessarily a lot of agreement on the actual substantive policies of governance itself. And so that's going to be a big challenge for this governing coalition going forward. I mean, there's some issues that they agree on, but there's a lot of fragmentation that exists, and it's going to be difficult to be able to just even govern itself. Mind you, all of these other distractions that exist in terms of trying to repair the democracy.
Exactly. I mean, governing alone is so difficult in any modern state. And when you think about the exhaustion that must be there in terms of how much it took to win these elections, and then how much extra complexity you have when you have a coalition government, really, really difficult. And what you end up with, and what we see in places like the US as well, is yes, you still have the existing parties, but the political cleavage becomes about democracy, yes or no. And you end up with very strange bedfellows. But I think some of the lessons, you know, that Poland has for other countries and that they should learn from others as well include, you know, we see how the 2024 elections are shaping up in the US. And it is this being played by many as a fundamental choice between democracy, yes or no. But one of the major issues for some people is that we're really starting to see the fruits of President Biden's refusal to tackle the courts issue because he thought court expansion was a step too far. But I think he may come to regret that. You know, we see how the court could be a key player in the coming year on everything like Trump's immunity from prosecution, his eligibility to stand as a presidential candidate, the convictions of the January 6th rioters. And that is just a reminder that with constitutional repair, we're not just talking about reform that is independent of time. There is a really strong temporal component where it's urgent, urgent, urgent to get certain fixes done because you really don't have a ton of time. And I think this is one more reason why, for me, we have to be very chary and very, very sort of rigorous about looking at options like natural turnover of judges or hoping that certain things will work out because there's just too much at stake. And I think it is an extremely difficult sort of challenge, but there are ways you can approach it in a better way than simply replicating the tactics of the previous government.
One big difference in the US case, though, is when Trump tried to challenge the election, the 2020 election, the courts, including many conservative justices on the courts, sided against Trump on those cases. And conservative justices oftentimes split from one another. I mean, it happens frequently. I get the sense that it's different in Poland. I get the sense that there isn't a real sense of genuine interpretation of the Constitution, but rather a more instrumental approach to this is what we need to do to get our policies done. And I think part of the reason for that is some of the justices who are on the court were appointed directly from Parliament. So they come from more of a political perspective than they come from a judicial perspective. And of course, many famous American justices were appointed from politics. I mean, think of Justice Warren. We think of Justice Marshall from history. But it does paint a very different picture when you're thinking of things in terms of politics throughout your life than interpreting court decisions throughout most of your life.
I think that's very true, although I wouldn't draw a hard line between the US Supreme Court and the Polish Constitutional Tribunal, but definitely I would agree with you that if we're thinking about this as a spectrum, the Polish Constitutional Tribunal is a captured court. And Margaret Atwood in The Handmaid's Tale uses the term on women that is used against certain women in the novel. And I see these courts as uncourts. They don't do anything that you would want a court to do. They're not independent of the partisan struggle. They don't have rigor in terms of how they approach their decision making and interpretation. And in that sense, you know, the Constitutional Tribunal is just a far down the spectrum from the US Supreme Court, but the US Supreme Court is traveling along that spectrum, in my view, and has traveled quite a far way along that spectrum compared to where it once was. Although there's always detractors. Some people will always say, you know, courts are making it up depending on what they ate for breakfast. But I think when you look in the detail, you can see a difference. There is still this strong qualitative difference in decision-making on the Polish Tribunal versus the US Supreme Court, for sure.
So as Poland looks to be able to do constitutional repair, the reforms that have been discussed, that I've heard discussed, things like adding additional justices to the Constitutional Tribunal, that feels a lot like a Band-Aid. It's not really a permanent solution. Like if this problem happens again, the new justices aren't going to fix it. The new populist government would just appoint new justices to replace them, especially as their terms expire. So what can a country like Poland do to avoid democratic backsliding, to avoid constitutional damage in the future?
Yeah, it's really important sort of when you consider repair. When I'm thinking about repair, it's really the most immediate priority fixes, which in some cases might just be Band-Aids, right? And I completely agree with you. So the US scholar Jack Balkin, and I put this in the paper, you know, he kind of divides it out into three different questions. One is repair. What are the short run fixes? The other is reform. You know, how are you going to reform the system? It might be through constitutional amendment. It might be through different means to reform institutions. Then the third one for him is maintenance. You know, how can we shore up or even create new institutions? And when you're thinking about Poland, I mean, some of the things that crop up are things like how the courts operate. One of the biggest issues with Poland is that with concentrated constitutional review, where only one court can do it, you're leaving one institution as the only institution that has to be captured. So one of the sort of calls during the peace government's time in office was by Tomasz Kontrowicz, who was saying he was calling on lower courts to take up the sort of baton and actually engage in constitutional review. The bigger version of that is, could you switch the system to a more sort of decentralized review where all courts or more courts have a role in constitutional adjudication? Of course, that would require a constitutional amendment, which is not really on the cards for the current government. But as a thought exercise, as a, when you're trying to think about democratic resilience, it is a big question. There's also, you know, how parliament operates. So could you make fast tracking certain types of legislation more difficult? For example, if it deals with the courts or with rights. And, you know, there's a new report by International IDEA on democratic resilience. They look at things like Denmark's system, where a minority of parliamentarians can actually force a delay of 1 year on legislation affecting rights. So things like this, kind of think about, how do you protect the core of the system? And then other things like, once again, having a more broad-based system, you were left under the peace dispensation with one institution being the only truly independent institution left, which was the ombudsman, Adam Bodnar, who's now the justice minister. And he was extremely active in terms of resisting to the furthest extent of his powers the, you know, measures being taken. But there's a whole new sort of literature on what we call fourth branch or guarantor institutions, things like the ombudsman or human rights commissions or, you know, integrity agencies and so on. And the question there is, do you possibly add more of them into the system so that any one of them could be activated as the site of resistance in the possible sort of reemergence of a peace or peace type government in the future? And much bigger questions that I sort of don't go into at all are things like, when you have a political environment so poisoned, do you have to start thinking about much further down the line, some form of reconciliation process? Not exactly like what you had in the likes of South Africa, but how do you stitch the democratic community back together? Does that require some action by government actors, not just hoping that the society and culture will take care of that themselves and take the lead? So major, major questions, but I think Poland is not alone in terms of what this looks like, the big questions and the big possibilities.
you make it more difficult for democratic backsliding or constitutional damage to happen in the future? Do you worry that it'll be more difficult to repair the Constitution or to reverse democratic backsliding in the future as well?
I think that once again, that's always a risk, right? It's just, you know, you're working on limited information and you're trying to think none of us is sort of omniscient. I think we're just trying to work on the best models and information that we have. I think this is one more reason why I wrote this paper, is that we're working on sort of outdated models or models that don't serve us, especially if you approach this from the point of view that this is akin to just major political reform in a broadly functioning democracy. You're missing out on a whole slice of what's actually at stake and the actual dynamics of what you're dealing with. Similarly, if you treat it as broadly just similar to transition to democracy from authoritarianism, I think you're going to simplify and distort the actual dynamics of what you're dealing with. So a lot of it for me is we have to be evidence-based, of course. We have to pull together the best evidence we have. We have to have very robust discussion about it that's inclusive. But ultimately, we cannot know all eventualities. And you're never going to have, and I think they say this in the International Idea Report, you're never going to have a backsliding proof system, a backsliding proof constitution. But what you can have is a sort of backsliding resistant constitution. And I think the harder you make it for an anti-democratic government to capture institutions, the harder you make it for them to enact laws without any sort of consultation whatsoever, hopefully you're getting somewhere that is more resistant. I think the biggest risk on top of that is you don't want a paralyzed system where government becomes less effective, because that's actually one of the feeders of democratic decay and backsliding, is people want effective government. And sometimes the view is that they haven't really been getting it. So very difficult, but changing our models is one of the real challenges here. If I can just make a very quick plug, I set up a working paper series on democratic decay and renewal, DemDeck, which is this online research platform that I've been running for years. And I really welcome submissions from people about these questions, especially about Poland, because I think we really need to have a very robust and full discussion about these issues, because we just can't get anywhere without, you know, really airing these fully.
So we've been talking about Poland because in many ways it's a unique case. I mean, it's one that we've been talking about in democratic circles for years now. I mean, thinking about the problems of backsliding within Poland, and now thinking about how do you reverse that backsliding? How do you go about constitutional repair? But should we be thinking about Poland as a unique case? Or is this an example that other countries can be able to see parallels with? Is this an example that other countries can learn from?
I think absolutely Poland can provide lessons to many countries around the world. I mean, that is one of the reasons I wrote a comparative sort of analysis to see what are some of the resonances. They're all unhappy in their own way, right? But what are the resonances and the insights that you can get from one system that can be helpful in another? And certainly, you know, you see some of the discussion from the debate on court packing in the US Supreme Court is helpful when you're considering court expansion. In Poland, some of the discussions about what is the place of fourth branch institutions in democratic resilience or being backsliding resistant can be useful to a range of countries. Things like what are the perils of having concentrated constitutional review, which has been considered the gold standard for decades. Poland shows us the perils of that. But Poland will also be showing us the endless ingenuity of constitutional thinkers who are genuinely committed to democracy in its many forms. That's one more thing we have to have our eye on. You have this extremely excellent scholarship coming from Poland and extremely adept and innovative constitutional thinking. And the more we can sort of surface that and connect it to what is being thought about elsewhere, I think the better. For me, it's often getting back down to practicalities like, of course, we have language barriers, but how do we sort of mitigate them? How do we bring people together? How do we, you know, translate what needs to be translated? So I think Poland will be an absolute sort of lesson for many countries around the world, both the negative challenges and positive possibilities.
Well, Tom, thank you so much for joining me once again. I want to plug the paper that you wrote one more time. It's called Constitutional Repair, Comparative Theory. Where can we find it again?
So it's at DemDec, which is Democratic Decay and Renewal. It's www.democratic-decay.org. And it's usually really easy to find. If you just Google DemDec and Constitutional Repair, you'll probably find it. You'll also find it pinned to my Twitter, sorry, X account, which is at Democracy Talk.
Well, that's great. Well, Tom, thank you so much for writing that. Thank you for joining me today. I also want to thank International Idea for helping connect us and for partnering to help produce this episode. So thank you so much once again.
Thank you. Delighted to be on your podcast. I'm a listener as well as a participant.
If you are listening to the show, please leave a review. It really does help shows like mine stand out. Also, please share the show with colleagues and friends, because word of mouth goes a very long way. Facebook and Twitter are great, but really just talk about it. There's a full transcript at www.democracyparadox.com. Thank you for listening.
The Democracy Paradox podcast is sponsored by the Kellogg Institute for International Studies, part of the Keough School of Global Affairs at the University of Notre Dame. The Kellogg Institute has a 40-year history of excellence in advancing research and education on global democracy and human development. Learn more about the Kellogg Institute, including its world-renowned visiting fellowships for scholars at various stages of their careers at kellogg.nd.edu.